Well, good afternoon, and welcome back from the last break of the day for the last session. And we have a couple of very interesting talks here for you. Should definitely get the juices flowing again for the afternoon. So if you haven't noticed, there's a theme to the day. We've been working our way up from the more policy, the more theoretical aspects to the more applied aspects. And there's a joke about that, but I'll save it for after this next talk when the room is full. We're still missing a lot of people out there. So that way I might get a few people that laugh. So we'll play the odds here. But very happy to introduce our next speaker, Jim Walsh, recently retired from Department of Health. And Jim is going to talk about one of those areas that has been touched upon throughout the day today, which is the Safe Drinking Water Act for all of its breadth and scope. Still is a little gray around the edges. It doesn't cover everything. And in Minnesota, at least, we always have this pressure to keep pushing on beyond the hard edges of the Safe Drinking Water Act, because we know that there are risks and concerns that are not completely addressed by the Safe Drinking Water Act. So even though the Safe Drinking Water Act covers over 100 contaminants, there are other things about which we know enough to be concerned about, and we do have to keep kind of pushing the frontiers a little bit on that. So Jim will talk about some of that pioneering work, which has yielded some unexpected results, and hence the title of the talk. So with that, I'll give you Jim Walsh talking about microbes in the mist.
Thanks, Sandeep. Wow, this thing is live. Okay. So I'm the last of the parade of retired presenters today, and you'll be pleased to know that following me will be Jane DeLambert, and I think she's going to bring the median age of the presenters down significantly. I was going to say by an order of magnitude, but I think she'd have to be a fetus for that to actually happen. If somebody could do the math on that for me. I'm retired 9 days strong at this point, but I think I've actually... Thank you. I think I've actually hit a groove, though, in terms of how to maximize my time efficiency. So this is a tip for anybody who's like approaching retirement age. So I break the day into thirds, and the first third of the day, I don't really do much of anything. I'm just kind of warming up, getting into the day. But the second third, I continue to not do anything. And then the last third, I'm asleep. So you're welcome for that life hack, as the kids would say. So the Pathogen Project is something that I've devoted much of the last 10 years of my time at MDH to. And I've been on the speaker circuit for the last couple of months prior to retirement, so you may have heard this before. If you have, you're welcome to nod off. If you haven't, I hope you'll be kept in rapt attention with what I have to say. So this is a project, as I say, that's been going on for some time. And because of the breadth and duration of the project, there are a lot of people to thank. Many of them are listed on this slide. Some are in this room, some are not. I'm only going to read off the top bit. So our funding partners was the Clean Water Council, Clean Water Fund, and then the lab work was done by our partners in Marshfield, Wisconsin, the Lab for Infectious Disease and the Environment. We partnered with the USGS, Upper Midwest Science Center, and also with the Minnesota DNR, and I'll explain how we partnered with them shortly. And then lots of people at MDH, most of which are listed here at the bottom of this slide. So why embark on a study like this? Well, in the early to mid-2000s, these types of headlines that you see in these publications were coming out of our neighbors to the east in Wisconsin. They were doing studies on the occurrence of viruses in groundwater and drinking water in Wisconsin, and they were finding it regularly in a wide variety of settings. So, private domestic wells, municipal wells in an alluvial aquifer in La Crosse, a restaurant well in the karst area of Door County, and even in the deep confined aquifers in Madison. So that got the attention of us at MDH as well as the Minnesota legislature, and then we were directed by them to conduct our own study. So beginning in 2014 and running through 2016, we conducted a statewide reconnaissance monitoring study that included sampling at 145 public wells, a mix of non-community and community, You can see the locations here as the blue dots. And the sampling was done on a bi-monthly basis, and it was done in two phases. So year one, you had a set of wells. Year two, you had a different set of wells. But 28 of the wells were carried over between years one and two. So 117 wells were sampled for 1 year bi-monthly, and 28 wells were sampled for 2 years. And what were they sampled for? We were looking for fecal pathogens and indicator parameters. So what's a pathogen? A pathogen is a microbe that can make people sick. And what's an indicator? That's a microbe that can't make you sick, but it indicates that there's some kind of a wastewater influence. And then looking at the categories of microbes that we were looking for, there were human enteric viruses. So enteric viruses are viruses that can live in the gut of humans and perhaps other animals. We were also looking at bacteria like Salmonella. That's a pathogen. And then Bacteroides is an indicator parameter. And then we were looking at protozoa like Giardia and Cryptosporidium. And these were all being analyzed for using the qPCR method. That stands for quantitative polymerase chain reaction. And that allows us to analyze for little strands of genetic material, so DNA and RNA. So that's what was being analyzed for primarily. And then we also analyzed for some chemical indicator parameters like nitrate, chloride, and bromide. At the same time, there was a community illness study that was conducted. It's called the WAVE study. I'm not going to have time to do that any justice today, but suffice to say that it consisted of additional sampling, weekly sampling at four sites, and that it is accompanied by a survey of residents for whether they were experiencing any illness during the time period. So what did the field activities look like? That's what this slide portrays. It was very time-consuming, putsy type of sampling work because the goal was to run 800 liters of water through basically a kidney dialysis filter. So it took, in most cases, many hours to collect the sample. They also took field parameters at the same time. We had some abnormally tall samplers, and we had some average-size samplers, so that was a complication. And we're at a geology conference. Let's talk about the geology of these wells. So again, their distribution is shown in this map, and now the underlying colors represent the near-surface pollution sensitivity as mapped by the state DNR. And the warm colors on here represent relatively high pollution sensitivities. In other words, there's either coarse material or fractured rock or karsted rock at the near surface, allowing water and contaminants to move into the subsurface pretty quickly. And where the cooler colors are present, you have finer grain materials in the near surface that prohibit the movement of water and contaminants. So you can see that these well points fall in both the high and low pollution sensitivity settings. And on the table on the left, you can see the breakdown by aquifer type. So most of the wells were finished in glacial aquifers, but the bedrock aquifers were also well represented. And if we compare the breakdown in aquifer types sampled by this study with all public water supply wells for which we have logs, which is about 7,000, so those are represented in the far right column on this table, you can see that the percentages, you know, while not one for one, we're fairly comparable. So we feel like we got a pretty good spread of aquifer types. Well, let's jump to the results. We were surprised at the high percentage of wells that had detection. So if you look for wells with any positive result, nearly every well, 96%, showed some type of detection. Wells that were positive for more than one microbe, 84%. Wells that were positive in more than one sampling round, similarly 81%. Wells with at least one result above 10 genomic copies per liter, that's the unit of measure for this particular type of analytical method, 44%. And the reason that that 10 number is significant, it's not a drinking water standard, but it represents a relatively high concentration above which we feel there's a greater likelihood that you have an intact organism that you're analyzing. Wells that were positive for Cryptosporidium, a protozoa, 40%, which was a very staggering number because it was previously thought that Cryptosporidium was primarily a surface water contaminant. And then wells positive for Giardia, 4%, finally drops off. So a high-level summary of this 2014 to 2016 data set, it's a bad news, good news story. The bad news, microbial detections were widespread, as I just said. 32% of wells had at least one human virus detection. 70% had at least one human pathogen detection. Some of the detections were high concentration. Our traditional risk indicators like coliform, E. coli, and pollution sensitivity didn't seem to predict the pathogen detections very well. And larger diameter pathogens appear to be entering groundwater. This includes relatively small percent of Giardia positive wells, but a relatively high percentage of Cryptosporidium positive wells. On the good news side, the detections were intermittent, so now we're looking at the sample level. Nearly 1,000 samples were collected, all told, and of those 1,000 samples, only 6% had a human virus detection, and only 22% had a human pathogen detection. So, and the concentrations were usually low, usually less than 10. And the important take-home here is not all detections represent infectious organisms. So we're analyzing strands of genetic material. We don't know if they're coming from an intact infectious organism or not. And finally, not all infectious organisms result in illness. We do feel, though, that the wells included in this study are not exceptional in terms of either being risky in their construction, in their geologic settings, or in their use. Those are generally good predictors of chemical contamination risk, as we've observed over time. But despite that, many yielded these detections of genetic material. So why is that? We think that the abundance of detections argues for a pretty widespread occurrence of this genetic material in the subsurface. So why would it be that we'd see more of this than, say, chemical contamination? Well, you know, there's a couple of reasons. One would be different source material, for sure. But also, this is a very sensitive analytical method. So in this table here, I've circled the basically the detection limit, if you will, for this particular qPCR method. And it's in the attograms of per liter, if you will, concentration, which is orders of magnitude lower than our most sensitive analytical methods for chemical contaminants. So we think partly what this is showing us is kind of the leading edge of what's happening in the subsurface, maybe in advance of other chemical contaminants that might be on their way down. We think this also means that there's a likelihood of multiple transport pathways for this material rather than some single smoking gun variable that's allowing this material to get into the subsurface. If you want to read more about this particular phase of the study, there's three publications you can reference. The first one came out in 2019. It focused on the surprising Cryptosporidium findings. It's in Environmental Science and Technology, and the lead author was from the Marshfield Clinic who did the analyses. Similarly, he was the lead author in our 2020 report on the general occurrence findings of the study that was published in Water Research. And then in 2022, there was a quantitative assessment of the health risk posed by the contaminants that we found, and it focused on Cryptosporidium being the driving factor for health risk from these findings. All right, so what we learned from that 2014 to 2016 study and in referencing the work of others is that you need several components for microbial contamination in the subsurface. You need a pathogen source, you know, that could be sewage, it could be some land use. You need a transport pathway, that could be well construction that's inadequate. It could be geologic conditions, it could be near surface conditions like land that's ponding water. And then you seem to need a special event, you need a recharge event, you need pumping to create steep vertical gradients and energize the system. And you need illness in the community to propagate the pathogens that are being detected. So we decided to approach the Clean Water Fund one more time to wrap up the project, and we did this over the last 4 years. And these are the three primary components that we focused on. This first row outlines the fact that we focused on analyzing the statistically analyzing the potential factors that could account for all the detections we found in the 2014 to 2016 data set. So why do that? And the goal for that would be to better determine the risk factors involved and better predict pathogen occurrence. Of course, the benefit would be better assessing sources and wells by risk. The status of that work is the analysis is complete. We have a manuscript completed and ready for submission to the Journal of Water and Health, and that if it hasn't happened already, it'll happen in the next month. We also conducted during fall of 2020 through fall of 2021 a recharge event monitoring study in cooperation with the USGS. The reason to do this is to better understand the timing and duration of these pulses of microbial material in the subsurface. And the resulting benefit would be to provide better guidance to public water systems on the prediction and management of these events, and also improve monitoring. The status of that work, the analysis is complete. There is a report and summary available on the MDH external webpage. We submitted a manuscript to Water Research on July 11th. We're still waiting to hear about the status of that paper. And then last but not least, we partnered with the DNR to conduct tracer studies at three of these four recharge monitoring sites. Those ran from fall 2020 to just recently wrapping up in June of this year. The reason to do that is to better document the pathogen transport pathways and the times of travel of this material, with the resulting benefit, hopefully, of recommending more enhanced well construction or setback distances for at least some wells in some settings. That work is also complete, and its analysis and the summaries are wrapped up in the recharge event monitoring papers. For this statistical analysis, it was completed in-house by Deanna Scher, who is a toxicologist at MDH who's steeped in statistical methods. And we threw at her more than 80 different factors that might be involved in controlling the occurrence of cryptosporidium. So we've broken them down into these categories: well construction and use, aquifer characteristics, variability in chemical indicators of human impact, things like chloride, bromide, and nitrate, and then land use within the well capture areas and potential contaminant sources in the inner well management zone, or IWMZ. And that's what Anita introduced to you previously. That's the 200-foot radius around a public supply well in which we survey potential contamination sources. And then the outcome that we were comparing those against was cryptosporidium occurrence from the 2014 to 2016 data set. Why focus on cryptosporidium? Well, it was found in that 2022 paper to be the primary driver of health risk. The reasons: it's disgustingly ugly, as you can see from this photomicrograph. Looks like an alien. It's poorly correlated with coliform, which is our usual indicator of risk. It's highly infective. It's tolerant of chlorine disinfection. And it's a fairly large organism, so it serves as a bellwether for possibly smaller organisms that could be on their way. In addition to analyzing that data, Deanna looked at precipitation data from 2014 to 2016 and compared it with our results. And the reason for doing that is to see if we could find out any patterns that we could then roll into our recharge study design. I'll talk about that more in a moment. This is just a cartoon view of what the contaminant sources that we evaluated and how we did so. So if our well here is shown inside of that black ring is the inner well management zone, the 200-foot radius. We looked at potential contamination sources there. We looked at the wellhead protection areas, the delineated well capture zones, both for the one-year time of travel, that's the red shaded area, and for the 10-year time of travel capture area, that's the blue shading. And then that the blue stippling here with the arrow indicates that we also looked at the land surface topography using LIDAR to assess the possible runoff area around each well. So I'm going to jump to the findings. So Deanna first looked at things from a univariable statistical analysis comparing each individual parameter against the cryptosporidium outcome. For those that passed a certain strength of statistical test for the univariable methods, she moved them on to multivariable modeling. So what I'm going to show you in these next series of rows are, by category, the individual factors that showed up as being important. And if they only showed up as important in the univariable modeling, then they're showed in regular font. But if they were important all the way through multivariable modeling, they show up in bolded font. So under well use and construction, I've broken these into two different columns. So the first one are things where I think they're kind of intuitive and make sense to most people. and probably reflect human causation. The second column is where you kind of have to scratch your head and wonder what it means. So for the first well use and construction theme, shallower well depth and depth casing showed up as being important. And I think that makes sense to most of us. That shows up in a lot of our work in terms of chemical contamination assessments. It just makes good intuitive sense. Also, well casings not extending far beyond the static water level. That maybe is a little less intuitive, but I've got a little diagram that I think will help with that. And then well casings not being fully grouted. I think that's also fairly intuitive, but let me just show you a little cartoon here about what I mean for both of those. So if this black solid bar represents a well casing, and underneath it is the well screen, and the gray shaded area around that represents the disturbed area caused by drilling. What Deanna's analysis found was you're better off if all of that disturbed area is filled with grout. She also found that if the static water level or phreatic surface, as indicated by the dashed lines here with the inverted blue triangles, if it's fairly close to the well intake, you have a greater chance of drawing the phreatic surface into the well. That's riskier. You get a smiley face if that phreatic surface is higher up away from the well intake. In terms of aquifer characteristics and how well connected they are to the land surface, she found that having a modern groundwater age based on tritium still had some predictive power for cryptosporidium occurrence, which is hopeful because we rely on that so heavily in our work. She also found that fractured bedrock aquifers or glacial sand and gravel aquifers were at greatest risk for cryptosporidium. That's probably because of the pore sizes that are available that would allow transmission of these larger organisms. And she found that greater geologic sensitivities or pollution sensitivities were linked to cryptosporidium occurrence, which is a hopeful outcome because we rely on those so heavily. On the non-intuitive side, she found that higher land surface elevation at the wellhead was important and having less drawdown with pumping. Those are a little less intuitive. We could probably debate about what the meaning of those, but I'm not going to have time to dive into that right now. In terms of what was going on in the well capture zone or the runoff area around the well, she found that having a relatively large runoff catchment area around a well and a relatively high percentage of impervious land within that capture area were linked with cryptosporidium occurrence. I think that makes some intuitive sense. She also found that within the one-year time of travel area well capture zone, having a relatively high percentage of open water or wetland was a risk factor, and that also extended to the 10-year time of travel area. On the non-intuitive side, she found that within that one-year time of travel well capture area, having an absence of development, residential, commercial, high intensity, low intensity, was linked with crypto, as was having mostly agricultural land. So that's an interesting finding and one I'd like to talk about later if we have time. Within the inner well management zone, she found that proximity to septic or sewage systems, especially being closer than 70 feet, was important, and especially if there were two or more of those present within that inner well management zone. On the non-intuitive side, she found that gravity trench treatment type systems, SSTSs, were riskier than mound systems, which seems a little counterintuitive, but again, maybe that's something we could hash through. And then in terms of the chemical and isotopic parameters, she found that having a high variability, or CV, coefficient of variability, for factors like bromide, nitrate, total organic carbon, chloride, boron, and specific conductance were linked to cryptosporidium occurrence. Similarly, having an elevated chloride-bromide ratio indicative of human impact was linked. And finally, she found that the MDH well scoring routine, we assess wells for their vulnerability and score all of the public wells in the state, she found that actually had some predictive power relative to cryptosporidium outcome, which was good news. On the non-intuitive side, she found having low variability for ammonia or ammonium was a risk factor, and that's one I don't fully understand. So if we break these findings down into recommendations, there's a little cartoon in the upper right that tries to help visualize some of this, but when you're siting wells, you probably want to avoid low spots that are prone to surface water runoff, especially if there's a lot of impermeable in that runoff area. You probably want to avoid the presence of open water or wetlands within that one-year time of travel well capture area, if you know it, and we do know that for most community wells in the state, at least. You probably want to avoid locating within 70 feet, and preferably more than 150 feet if you have the luxury of septic and sewage sources, especially if there are multiple. You probably want to avoid, on the construction side, shallow wells. She found that wells that were less than 118 feet were twice as likely to have cryptosporidium than deeper wells. And if they're finished in geologically unprotected fractured bedrock or sand and gravel aquifers that display young water based on tritium and flashy chemical sampling results, high variability, that's something you want to avoid. For monitoring, she found that we should promote repeat sampling for parameters like chloride, bromide, and nitrate to assess their variability and serve as potential surrogates for microbial risk. And then for our well vulnerability assessments that we conduct already at MDH, she found that, you know, they're pretty good right now, but we could bolster them by adding some of the unaccounted for variables that aren't currently in there, and then providing a more thorough weighting of the ones that are in there so they reflect these findings. And that's especially true possibly for wells where we're trying to assess groundwater under the direct influence, or GUDI, GUDI. And that, by that I mean under the direct influence of surface water. Okay, and then when she looked at the precipitation data from the 2014 to 2016 data set, she found that the greatest total microbial load that was observed during that phase of the study was found within either 2 or 7 day lag periods after a heavy rainfall. In a separate analysis conducted at MDH, they found that precipitation occurring in 24 hours prior to sample collection, even a fairly small rainfall, was most associated with human enteric virus detections. So the take-home message is contamination occurs quickly after precipitation events, and we wrapped that into our design of the recharge study. So this is what that study looked like. We did a very focused burst of sampling at the very start of a rainfall event that was forecast to be a half an inch or greater. Starting 10 days prior to that, we would do a low-intensity sampling phase, and then you can see how things ramp up as it approaches the time of the rainfall. And then after 8 or 9 days of high-intensity sampling, we backed off to a low-intensity phase. So all told, for each sampling event, it constituted a time span of about 30 days, over which time around 20 to 25 samples were collected. Where was this done? Here's a map of the tracer study sites. One up in northeastern Minnesota, sites 2 and 3 down in the Central Sands, site 4 down in southeast Metro. And here's a little cartoon of what the geologic settings looked like. So site 1 finished in fractured crystalline bedrock, fairly typical for the area, very short well casing with a long uncased open borehole. Site 2 was finished in geologically unprotected glacial sand and gravel with a little deeper depth to water. You see the static water table represented here also. Site 3 was in a similar kind of depth range as site 2, also finished in glacial sand, but now with a little bit of clay till over the top. And site 4 was finished in deeply buried Paleozoic sandstone, the Tunnel City group, and a very deep static water level close to the Mississippi River, so there was 180 feet of dry material above it. Sampling was conducted in automated fashion. That's the only way it could be done, to collect samples on this kind of a burst schedule. These samplers were designed and built by the USGS out of their Midwest Science Center in Wisconsin. Basically, Dave Owens, who built these and who this publication is based on, took and repurposed old beverage coolers. He took the guts out and he installed these sampling filters with the valving and tubing and pumps. There was battery backup. There's even a toaster on the top. That's actually a data logger. And we could trigger the sampling by cell phone. So when we saw the rain coming, had the 10-day forecast in hand, go ahead and trigger sample collection, and this would all start operating. Other components, we included paired observation wells and weather stations at each site. The most disgusting part of the project involved paired wastewater sampling, where we would actually grab samples from the most adjacent septic systems or municipal sewers. We conducted detailed age dating, tritium, helium, and SF6 methods. We did annular space testing. The picture on the right here represents us doing this at one of the sites. We mixed up a brine solution. We used a high-tech garbage can with the bottom cut out of it and then screwed it into the ground and introduced the brine and then measured specific conductance for a period of weeks to see if there was any breakthrough. And then at the fractured rock site up in northeastern Minnesota, we conducted borehole logging in conjunction with the MGS. Here's some of the data from Site 2. This is the unprotected sand and gravel site in the Central Sands area. I'm showing you two images here. The one in the upper left is from the fall of 2020. The one in the lower right is from spring of 2021. The red dots on here represent the microbial detections. So if they plot along the x-axis, that means it was a non-detect. If they plot above that, it was detected at the concentration shown on the right axis. The blue dots on here represent cumulative precipitation over the recharge event. The light blue dots with the gray lines represent what was going on at the observation well in terms of water level. What I want you to take away from this, in the lower right, the gray represents snowpack coming and going, melting and returning. What I want you to take away from this is, first, in fall of 2020, how irregular the detections were. You could be out sampling one day and get a detection, and the next day you would get nothing. Also, the black rings around the red dots here represent a microbial detection on the same day that rainfall was occurring. If you see instead a black arrow with a number, that means that's the lag time in days between a rainfall event and when the microbes were detected. So in the fall of 2020, we had, sure, several days where you had coincident occurrence of rainfall and microbial occurrence. But look what happened in the spring of 2021. So fall of 2020, you were pivoting from a relatively dry time period to a wet one, whereas it stayed wet into the spring of 2021. And as soon as snowmelt started in the spring of 2021, you can see that almost every microbial result was a detection, and almost everyone is circled, in fact, representing that there was either snowmelt or rainfall occurring on that day. So high variability, but much less so in the spring, and the risk factor seems much greater in the spring. We saw this pattern repeated at each of the four sites. This is a composite graph from Site 1, the fractured bedrock site up in the northeast. So now what I'm showing is composite information about lag times. And now I'm showing them against a backdrop of the prevailing moisture conditions. So on this graph, we took information from Minnesota climatology. If the preceding period was especially dry compared to historic standards, it's shown in red, or I should say brown shading. If it was normal, it would be in green, and if it was wetter than normal, it's shown in blue. And then the gray stippling on here represents frozen ground conditions, winter conditions. The blue dots on here, the dark blue, represent minimum lag times in days. The gray represents average. The goldenrod represents median, and the brown represents maximum. So one thing we observed at all four sites, the shortest lag times were observed in the spring and during wet conditions, even when there were ostensibly frozen ground conditions. And similarly, we observed that the longest lag times were observed during dry conditions. You remember how dry the summer of 2021 was? It was officially a severe drought. That kicked up the lag times. If we compare data from like this from all four sites, that's what I've done here, and I've indicated the depth to water at each site with an inverted blue triangle in the depth. And sites 1 and 4 are the bedrock aquifers. They're linked by the arrows here. You see similarities in the response curves. You see, first off, that detection, the lag times were shortest in the spring at all of the sites, longest during and after drought conditions. But there was a dependency on aquifer type and depth to water. It seems like the bedrock aquifers, even with the significantly different depth to water, responded very similarly. Same could be said of the two glacial sand sites. If we now turn that on its head and look not at lag times, but at the microbial detection information, so percent positive samples, concentrations, etc., you get this kind of a picture. So now we have the the same colorizing of the background, but now the blue dots represent percent positive samples, the goldenrod represents the highest observed concentration, the russet represents the microbial sum for everything detected during a sampling round, and then the gray represents that value normalized by the number of samples. What we observed is that concentrations, the highest observed microbial concentrations, peak after the dry to wet transition, and they continue to drop in concentration with increasing moisture, but the detection frequency continues to rise. This continues into the spring thaw and then only drops after the drought conditions are observed. So again, similar patterns observed at all four sites, but what we did observe is this pattern was offset in time at site four where the depth to water was so great. So we think that's telling us something about vadozone transport pathways and times and what an impact it has here. This is a quick summary of our age dating results. So at three of our sites, we were able to get an average bulk age for the water ranging from 15 to approximately 30 years. At one of the sites, the water is a mix of very young and ancient water. But the maximum lag time we saw between rainfall and microbial detection was no more than 2 or 3 weeks. So that tells us is that during recharge events, you have a trickle or a small stream of this young water rapidly moving into the aquifer, but it's a very small component. So if you do a mass balance calculation of what percent it may constitute of, say, the well water volume, it's a pretty small percent. So we were able to back out contributions of less than or equal to 20% at site one, less than or equal to 10% at site two, and down to single digits, 1 or 2% at sites three and four. This is a view of some of the tracer work that was done by our partners at DNR. And through their work and the results that we found between comparing the wastewater and the drinking water, we were able to kind of try to pinpoint the sources of the microbes at each of these sites. So at site one, the most commonly detected organism was an indicator, Bacteroides. We suspect it's coming from the sewage lift station and its associated piping. The distance to those sources, 55, 70 feet. If they're in red, that means they fall within the emergency response area or one-year time of travel area for the well. One of the distances out to 180 feet. The basis for our suspicion, coincidence with the wastewater sample results, as well as some of the tracer findings that John and his team found. At site two, we found Giardia very commonly. We believe it's coming from their septic systems. They have two on site. The distances are 88 and 140 feet, both fall within the one-year time of travel area for the well, and we determine that based on coincidence. Okay, I'm going to have to fly here, so I'll let you take a look at those last couple. So here are the key findings. We found that the greatest chance of microbial detections and the shortest lag times occur between rainfall and occur in wet periods, especially during spring thaw. Lowest detection frequencies, longest lag times during and immediately after dry conditions. Greatest concentrations follow this transition from dry to wet with a lag time set by the vadozone thickness. Recharge may be occurring despite other indicators of frozen ground. Chemical and isotopic indicators may reflect recharge and help assess risk, but they're not as sensitive as this qPCR method, so they're not direct surrogates. Porous media vadozones and aquifers may still behave like pipes at localized scales. I think it looks like this. You have contributions to the subsurface from leaking or designed systems. Microbes accumulate during dry periods. They're driven down during wet. And that rapid movement is made possible by small-scale high permeability features and accentuated by energizing of well pumping. These pulses represent volumetrically small contributions to these aquifers, but at timescales much shorter than the bulk aquifer water age. That has implications for well vulnerability assessments, use of enriched tritium versus ultra-low level, as discussed earlier. The high variability means single or infrequent sampling is unlikely to adequately characterize risk. And this reinforces the importance of disinfection as a barrier, where disinfection itself does not create its own problems. So these are our recommendations. We should monitor wells for microbial risk, especially goody in the spring or during other wet periods for increased chance of detection, and sample repeatedly if possible. To catch maximum concentration, sample after this transition from dry to wet if you have the luxury. incorporate information on antecedent and prevailing moisture conditions when evaluating past monitoring data or planning for future studies. Incorporate repeat sampling and continuous monitoring for parameters like chloride, bromide, and specific conductance as analogs for risk. Transition to the use of ultra-low-level tritium for well vulnerability determinations and factor other parameters like chloride-bromide ratio, taking a weight-of-evidence approach. Evaluate comparability of these findings with other high-sensitivity chemical studies and methods such as PFAS compounds like PFBA. Incorporate tracer and borehole logging studies where appropriate. And in terms of water system operation and risk management, use all the data that you have if you have the luxury when siting wells to keep them away from contaminant sources, up gradient and outside of the well capture area if you can. Consider the use of storage if you're a community system that has that luxury to help ride out these periods of high risk. Promote disinfection where they don't create problems, but note that you need to use UV or filtration in the case of crypto because chlorine alone won't do it. Okay, that's what I have, and I know I'm up to time, so thanks for your time today.
Big thank you to Jim, and for a price, you can get his retired email from me if you have questions for him. But in all seriousness, the work that Jim's talking about is going to continue at MDH. So we will hopefully we'll be back talking about it. And any questions, please direct them to me, and we'll put you in touch with Jim's co-authors on this study.